From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in Indianapolis, Indiana, on a main street. Two police officers driving in their car pulled over a driver, and they asked him to pull into a side alley. The driver was a tall black man, and he later would say that the reason for the traffic stop was never made clear to him. He was not aware of having a broken taillight. He didn't think he had been speeding. Well, after handing over his license and registration, the officers noticed something in his back seat, a cello. The driver explained calmly that the cello was his own. In the driver's recollection, the officers laughed at this, then accused him of having stolen it. He says they gave him two options. They could place him under arrest, or he could prove the cello was his by playing it for them. The driver told them he would choose option number two. He stepped out of the car, and there, in an Indianapolis alley, a man played this for the two officers. This is Bach's Cello Suite number 3 in C major. And as you might imagine, he was not arrested. The officers let him go. He says they joked with him about the incident, even though he wasn't laughing. He didn't find it funny. That man is Edward Kelsey Moore. He is now a professional cellist living in Chicago. He's also a writer, and he shared a story recently writing, quote, "This story tells a lot about my experience as a cellist, and in particular, as a black cellist. I'm someone for whom a wonderful piece of music is permanently connected to one of those moments of casual humiliation that sometimes happen to people who look like me," end quote. In other words, for Edward Kelsey Moore, it took a piece of music to stop an arrest. That piece of music bridged a divide, and it has us wondering, what else can music do? That's what cellist Yo-Yo Ma was wondering when he created the Silk Road Project, launched in 2000. It's a collaboration among artists, institutions that promotes an exchange of ideas, the studying of concepts, cooperation among musicians that can allow music to break down differences and barriers. There's a new documentary that tells that story. It's called The Music of Strangers, Yo-Yo Ma and the Silk Road Ensemble. Last night, the Little Theater hosted a screening and discussion, and the Little is giving you one more chance to see this film, and I think you should. Saturday, 1 p.m. Saturday at 1 p.m. for a chance to see The Music of Strangers. This hour, we're going to discuss the film, the project, and the power of music, and the director of that film, Morgan Neville, is going to join us in our second half hour. But first, let me welcome our guests in studio, and I am so glad that my colleague Mona Segetola-Slami is here. She's a host and producer of Classical 91.5. She's in studio, who always makes me feel more comfortable and slightly smarter about music than I deserve. Thank you for being here.
Good to be here, Evan.
I know you've seen the film and have a lot to say about these subjects, so it is great to have Mona. Also here, Ellen Koskoff. Ellen is a professor of ethnomusicology and director of the ethnomusicology programs at the Eastman School of Music. Ellen, welcome to you.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And Alexander Pena is here. He's the director of the Rock Music Collaborative, which, for our listeners who might not know, Alexander, is what?
Well, thank you for being here. It's an honor to be here, Evan.
Yeah, sure.
And the Rock Music Collaborative is a nonprofit collaborative initiative here in downtown Rochester, and we provide full scholarships for classical music study, but also classical music tradition, basically instrumental study through a variety of mediums and styles. Our program is for kids grades 1 through 12, and it is primarily for RCSD students, but any child that lives in Rochester can receive a full scholarship for study. And we're a partnership collaborative between the Hochstein School, the Eastman School of Music, University of Rochester, Rochester Philharmonic, the City of Rochester Department of Recreation Youth Services, and the Rochester City School District as well.
And Alexander, every year, somewhere in the music media, someone writes a piece about the impending death of classical music, opining that it's become all old, rich, and white. It can't survive into the future. And you see, I know that you see and you work to ensure that that's not necessarily true.
Evan, every year I'm surprised by not just one, but several students who literally learn like some of the classical hits. We're talking The Swan or, Elgar Cello Concerto by ear, purely on a YouTube video that they have discovered on their own and listened to and learned by themselves without their teacher. So I do not believe that classical music is dying at all.
I love some of those stories. And before the hour even began, first of all, I thanked Mona for sending me along that story that I shared off the top, the story of Edward Kelsey Moore, the professional cellist. So thank you, Mona, for sharing that. I mean, that just moved me so much. But Ellen, you've said those stories are, unfortunately, that's not the only story like this that you've ever heard.
No, it is not. I've heard this story told slightly differently from a number of different people. And this is essentially what I study and teach is the relationships between music and social and cultural processes and ideas about people and who they are and so forth. So that story is very sad, but unfortunately, it's true.
And to me, one of the things it says is we still have so much further to go if a black man cannot have logically been assumed to have owned a cello.
Yes, absolutely. We don't normally, most of us do not associate classical music with African-American culture, but I always ask, why not?
Yeah.
These are social and class issues that we're still working on.
Well, we're going to be talking to the director of the film in our second half hour. We're going to learn a lot more about the Silk Road Project. But Mona, for someone like you who live in the classical music world, you've been aware of this a lot longer than I have. I heard about this and I thought, wow, this is such a beautiful idea. And the film shows how this project, this collaborative, came together. And it shows you how someone from Syria and Iran, Spain, the United States, sometimes you look at music and you say, can this fit together? You know, let me just start with the film itself. What did you think of the film?
I just thought, particularly moving all the different cultures, the different music, and I grew up in pretty standard Western traditional classical music, even though part of my heritage is that my dad is from Iran, but, you know, I grew up New Jersey with a more typical, I guess, American upbringing, but also that they do it so well, all of their different things. And also, if you see the trailer, I just find, like, a story seems simple at first, right? It's really idealistic, like, can music stop a bullet, he says in the trailer, but they don't show. And then in the movie, you see he answers next, no, it doesn't, but what do I do with that fact? My family's struggling, what is the point of music? And there's a lot of idealistic things, but it's still something that I think a lot of people struggle with, even if music is going to bring us together or music does all these different things, that there is a question of what is the point when people are starving, can't stop the war, can't make the old young again, all that.
You're referring to, I think, the Syrian gentleman who asks, you know, can music stop a bullet? And he says, no, it can't. But I still felt one of the conclusions that I was left with was, it's not that music can stop a bullet or can stop a violent altercation as it's happening, but certainly it can be a component to building a world where there is less violence, because there will be less division, there's less suspicion, there's less fear of the unknown. Mona, I saw the music come together in this project, and we are talking about different cultures, even different sort of musicalities and approaches, and somehow they stitch together. I mean, I'd love to hear what all of you think about the actual music of Silk Road. I found it remarkable.
Yeah, I think I'll defer a bit more to some of our musical experts, but the only other thing I want to get to is people talk about music as a universal language, and I think it might be universal in a sense like language, but music means different things in different cultures, mm-hmm. different contexts. That doesn't necessarily change how we can appreciate it. That could be written for a certain, you know, ceremony, but it might just be a piece you put on in the background. You know, not all music is created equal, but it can be experienced equally in different ways. So there's also issues of how we think about it. But that's, you know, some of the fascination, that there are things that overlap, but that music isn't necessarily universal. This thing that means something in Chinese music might mean something else in European music and French music. The same notes or combination of notes can signify different things. And so that's, I think, a whole world to get into.
Mm-hmm. And Ellen, I asked before the hour began, I'm going to ask you now on the air, because I thought your answer to this was just so interesting. When you listen to some of the Silk Road music, particularly the piece that opens the film that's just rocking, it is a kind of piece of music I'd never heard before. And even though you've got someone from Syria, Iran, and Spain, and of course, Yo-Yo Ma, and people from all these different places playing with their own approaches. And it feels like this is not a group that's playing a Russian piece or an American piece or a Chinese. It feels like every part of the culture is somehow stitched in, but it doesn't feel disjointed. And you had a comment for why that is.
Yeah, I was struck by that, too. I should confess that when I hear about fusion musics, I get really nervous. And to me, this means Western tonality and chord structures have taken over. And to me, that's not a good, that doesn't show sort of respect and integrity for the other, for other musics. Mm-hmm. So I was delighted when I started to watch this movie, because it was just incredibly well done musically. I mean, it's incredibly well done in a lot of different ways, but musically, it made sense to me because it used bits and pieces of the different cultures, and it used improvisation, which is something we don't sort of always use, especially in the Western classical system. It used the musical structure of the drone, which is a wonderful musical idea in which you have a pitch that is sustained throughout a piece of music upon which you can improvise melodically. And that's pretty much what that music was. But the best part of it was that there was no one music that was dominating. So you didn't hear Western chord structures. You didn't hear necessarily all the licks you could hear in Persian music. You didn't hear any of the sort of Spanish flamenco stuff that might have happened. You heard a third space or another space was created musically for all of these wonderful musicians to interact with dignity and respect without giving up anything of their own.
Yeah, amazing. And so you're going to have to go on Saturday at 1 p.m. if you want a chance to see it at the Little Theater. That's your next chance to see it. Alexander, what do you think?
I absolutely agree. I mean, I think I had that same feeling of skepticism when I started to think about this kind of melting pot for, you know, sort of a word that describes that kind of possibility of music just getting all mixed together. And that can go either very well or very poorly. And I think what they did in the film and what the group did, it was amazing. And I think for me, when I was watching the film, partially because maybe I'm a performing musician myself, it was those moments that they shot before the concerts or in between rehearsals where the people were actually, the musicians of the ensemble were really warming up, but truly improvising and just kind of playing off of each other and feeling it. And it wasn't this kind of improvisation that had rules to it because of a classical tradition or a certain type of writing or group of notes or, you know, harmonies or that kind of thing. It was really just playing off of what they know, their own experiences, what they did, what they brought to the table. And I just thought that clearly was what resonated in the final product as well. It felt very improvisatory. It felt like they were staying true to who they were, but also allowing for moments of improvisation and that sort of thing.
So, Mona, I know you had a chance to pull some of the music. I sort of just kind of defer to you. What we ought to hear?
I think if people are talking about the music that is from the beginning of the film, the one that's called Arabian Waltz, I think, shows up pretty prominently in that, and I think that's interesting sounding. So if we have that recording.
Let it kind of play underneath us, and we can bring it back up if we want there. But Ellen, is there some of the drone that you talk about?
Yeah, and the camanche, which is the string instrument, is improvising over that. He starts, and then the others sort of follow in.
Mona?
Yeah, just there's percussion, and I think percussion from several different traditions end up mixing in several of the pieces, and that creates an interesting effect. And perhaps also that emphasis on certain rhythms that differs from what we consider traditional Western classical music, where people do think a lot about the notes and the chords. Rhythm's important, but other traditions, I think, stand apart with rhythms like these.
Right, and the melodic structure isn't similar to our system either, so this is often something that people use to critique this music. It's not singable. But it is. You just have to learn the sort of rules of how it works.
What do you hear now, Alexander?
I think immediately what I hear, again, as an educator, are some of the distinct rhythmic patterns, the ostinatos, the repeated kind of rhythmic strings. They are very much mixed and unique to their own, but they're also not sort of the obvious, like you were saying, with flamenco rhythms and that kind of thing. There's a lot of unique rhythms and patterns that you can stick to, and I can imagine immediately think of teaching this to children and finding different ways of dancing to the music and that are different gestures that we see in Western classical tradition.
I want to bring up a word that may come to mind for some who have questions about how you blend cultures, blend styles, blend musical backgrounds, and that's appropriation. And I don't bring it up as an allegation. I bring it up as sort of a conversational question on, you know, if, well, you know, I mean, the great classical musician Justin Timberlake was just accused of cultural appropriation recently. And, you know, it's a question that comes up across the musical spectrum. But Ellen, I want to start with you. How do you learn about other cultures? How do you sit with another musician from another country, from another style? How do you learn what they do? How do you create something together without appropriation sort of maybe infringing on some of that?
Yes, appropriation is an interesting word, and it's something that ethnomusicologists talk about all the time, and something that has been taken seriously under copyright law in the United States. Appropriation, of course, is taking a music of another culture and simply cleaning it up or making it sound commercial enough to sell, and then selling it. Ethnomusicologists try to, when we do our field work and we record music, we try to pay back or give back. The notion of reciprocity is important. They're giving us something cultural value. We want to give them back. And as I said before, one of the really wonderful and incredibly ethical aspect of this movie is that the musicians who collaborated with Yo-Yo Ma were all treated with sort of equal deference and equal respect. And I think that is what is the most important factor. There was a wonderful scene. This is a spoiler alert. near the end of the movie, there's this wonderful scene of a family playing in China, playing a group of probably homemade musical instruments and a wonderful puppet show, shadow puppets. And these folks had been doing this, and they were upset because they had not been able to teach it. And the one Wu Man, who was the pipa player, took these folks, and she brought them into the United States to play concerts. And she took them exactly as they were, as a family. So, yes, she benefits from that, but so do they. So there's a sort of even exchange between the music and people. And that was just incredibly beautiful in this movie.
It sounds like the way that you make sure appropriation is not becoming part of what's happening is trying to establish mutual respect, trying to establish the space for a performer to have their room, and not sort of stealing it, appropriating it, or taking it for other reasons other than sort of understanding and respect, Ellen?
Right, and not only that, but learning how to pay back in a way that's culturally meaningful to the people you're working with. So, for instance, when I did field work among Hasidic Jews in Brooklyn for my dissertation, they made me promise, and I've stuck to it, they made me promise to play a tune every time I talk about their music, to play a tune because God is in the music and will speak to an audience. So that's not money. I didn't pay them, but I did pay them in a way that was meaningful to them. And that's sometimes difficult to know. We think money is the way we do everything, and money is really the cheapest way to pay.
Alexander, what do you think?
You know, I see this in the way that I run some of the rock music curriculum even. We had a summer camp week at the end of June for our students to participate in, and I have a staff that are all teaching performing artists. And one day each week, we had them present a different style of music about the instrument. So we did the violin, the viola, the cello, and the bass, but also something that was, you know, outside of the classical style, because we also didn't want to make it seem like our program is so classically based that that's the only way that you can learn music. So we had one of our musicians play a little bit of jazz on the bass. We had one of our violinists, she's an Americana specialist, and she played different kinds of folk tunes from Ireland, from the Appalachian, from all over. And like what you were talking about, it was about a mutual respect for all kinds of music. It was really about presenting this opportunity and this experience to our, you know, students that classical tradition is a wonderful way to learn music, but really all music is wonderful in itself. It trains musicians. It makes us stronger players, but also, again, the idea that you can express and communicate more deeply through the more exposure that you have is really an ideal that we really try to build into the curriculum at Rock Music.
Mona Sekatola Salami?
Well, I often get to thinking about, you know, who kind of gets to decide in terms of traditions and stuff. Certainly, it comes up in the movie that some of the people in the Silk Road Ensemble, the Galician accordion player, doing something with people was sort of accused of not keeping to the tradition. But is a tradition, you know, if it's changing and incorporating modern things, is that the more authentic thing because it's the living tradition that's changing? Or is it the thing where you say we can only do it the way it was done a long time ago? And who decides we are doing the better thing? Is it the outsider who's interested in it and wants to keep it safe, or the person inside who said, this is just, you know, we've just started adding ketchup to our recipes because it was there and it was a good ingredient. Forget what's traditional, right? You know, this is just how we do it now.
But it's interesting you bring up ketchup and recipes. I mean, appropriation happens in food culture. It happens in many different things. Ellen, for me, I've always felt when the word appropriation comes up, I tend to think of who has power and privilege versus who doesn't, and cultures and communities that don't have power and privilege or are sort of vulnerable to exploitation through appropriation. Is that
absolutely? Yeah, that's very true. But the question of authenticity and pureness is has been debated a lot, and ethnomusicologists have sort of given up on that question because we understand, or most of us understand, that all music traditions are made from other music traditions, so that there's always been intersections and fusions of musics throughout history. The issue of whether or not something is pure or whether or not it's becoming diluted is a sort of social construction that certain cultures make about certain musics because, as Evan is saying, the power issues are important and musical performance is embedded in, I should say the power situations are embedded in musical performance. So people will construct categories called authentic music and whatever music, but these are not really telling the true story that music, just like people, all social groups and all musics are a blend of many traditions.
Well, in a moment, we're going to get a chance to talk to the director of the film. Before we do that, Mona, maybe one more piece of music we could listen to?
Okay, yeah, I'm sure. I think there's one, or there are a couple different depictions of galloping horses. Maybe pick one of them.
All right, so Mona, you chose this one. Tell me a little bit about what you're hearing here.
Well, part of it is just thinking, as we were talking about the different respecting the traditions, hearing the pipa as being played here, that in the movie you can hear Wuman playing, I think, I forget if it's Iron Man or some sort of current pop, you know.
That's right, yeah.
You know, playing Black Sabbath on pipa. So here's someone who respects the tradition so much, but also has joy in playing different things, unexpected things.
I think she's cracking
things
up when she's playing. Yeah. I mean, she's having so much fun when she's doing that as well.
Yeah.
Ellen, what are you hearing?
Well, I know from studying Chinese culture that the horse is a very powerful symbol. You see it in art and carvings and so forth. So there are many, many pieces of Chinese and Central Asian musics that are based on horses. The Comanche that was being played is also found in China, and it's often carved with a horse head on it. So it's a nod to Central and East Asian culture at the same time as a connection with Western culture. You hear that glissando going up and down, so it's so cool.
The whinnying horse there.
That's right.
Yeah.
Couple of things here, a couple of listener comments. Pam writes and says, Evan and guests, I'm crushed that I will be unable to attend the screening on Saturday. I have an acquaintance with the member of the Silk Road Ensemble, and I've always loved the music and the message. Please tell me the Little will screen the documentary again. That's from Pam in Bloomfield. Pam, I don't know offhand. Mona,
I don't know. I organize a series called Classical 91.5 Presents, and we couldn't get the movie on our series because we were already booked with playing Triplets of Belleville later this Saturday, but maybe next year we can add an encore as part of our series.
Yeah, and so Pam, sorry about that, but for listeners, if you're just joining us, your other chance to see the film, The Music of Strangers, Yo-Yo Ma and the Silk Road Ensemble, is Saturday at 1 o'clock at the Little. So I know that we'd love to see you there. The film is beautiful. And one other question from a listener just wants to know, still struggling to understand when it's appropriation and when it's just you're doing something because you like it. I'm going to let Ellen answer this, but Ellen, here, I had a friend once say something like, well, I love this cuisine. I'm not allowed to make it. And I thought, well, I thought of my friend Norma. I thought of arroz con habichuelas. I thought of things like that. If I love arroz con habichuelas and I want to make it and I respect, you know, my Puerto Rican friends who introduced me to it, that's one thing. And I think that's out of respect and I like to make it and I learn about another culture. It's another if I want to market it and sell it, especially when the people from which that idea or product or food or music comes are struggling and maybe not benefiting. That's always been how it's been in my mind. How would you answer the listener's
right,
question?
Right. I would answer it the same way. A lot of appropriation is defined by the capital that you are getting from the appropriation. It can be money, or it can be power, or it can be some form of cultural capital. So the idea when you take something is to make it an even exchange. So if you want to, say, make a recipe that you've never done or listen to certain musics that you've never listened to, that's great because you're going at it for the reason of respect and curiosity, trying to learn a bit. But if you use that music in a way that benefits you in some larger way than just simply your curiosity, ethically, you have some responsibility to pay back. So if Evan wants to make that dish and then sell it as his, that's probably appropriation.
Yeah.
But if he wants to make the dish and invite all of his friends over to check it out, that's just Evan being a good guy.
Let's get our only break of the hour. And when we come back, we're going to talk to Morgan Neville, who's the director of The Music of Strangers, Yo-Yo Ma, and the Silk Road Ensemble. That's the documentary that you can see as part of The Little's One Take documentary series. I played last night with a panel discussion, and the other showing is Saturday at 1 o'clock at The Little. If you're just joining us, the film has inspired this discussion about the power of music, about blending and breaking down cultural barriers, about how to do that with respect that we think the Silk Road Collaborative, that this project, that this ensemble has been doing now for a number of years. So let's get a break, come back, talk to the director next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on the next Connections, first hour. Do the Buffalo Bills need a new stadium to stay in Western New York? And if they do, should taxpayers pay for it? Our panel looks at the latest. We'll also talk cost benefits when it comes to using your tax dollars for stadiums. Second hour, Rochester Police Chief Mike Simonelli joins us in studio, answering our questions and yours about what happened this past weekend with local demonstrations. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. The first screening at The Little for The Music of Strangers, Yo-Yo Ma and the Silk Road Ensemble sold out. So if you're planning to go on Saturday at 1, that's wonderful. You might want to get tickets in advance just to make sure that you can get in because it is a gorgeous film and a lot of interest in this. We're discussing it in studio with my colleague from Classical 91.5, Mona Segatola-Slami, Alexander Pena, who's the director of the Rock Music Collaborative, and Alan Koskoff, who is a professor of ethnomusicology and director of the ethnomusicology programs at the Eastman School of Music. And on the line with us is Morgan Neville, who is the director of The Music of Strangers. Morgan, thank you for taking the time for the program. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Well, you know, we've been discussing the film, and we've been discussing some of the themes in the film, but let me just sort of step back more broadly and ask you how you gravitated toward it and how the project came together.
Well, you know, I'm a musician myself, and I've been making documentaries about music off and on for 20 years. And I had the opportunity to meet Yo-Yo about 5 years ago, and it was one of those kind of life-changing evenings where we ended up having this three-hour conversation, and within 15 minutes, he was telling jokes, and after an hour, we were talking about philosophy, and after 2 hours, we were talking about our family, and I came away with a couple of ideas. The first one, which is kind of my documentary idea, which is I'll follow this guy with a camera anywhere. you have that kind of instinct. But the other thing is that the ideas he was talking about, of the things he struggled with in his life, trying to figure out what art means, does culture matter, how useful is culture as a tool for social change, these are things, as somebody who makes films and films about culture, the same questions I've been asking myself for a long time. So I came out of that thinking, I don't know exactly where this film's going to go, but it's asking these questions I'm asking. And we kind of decided that night to make a film using the Silk Road Ensemble, which has been kind of his primary way of trying to understand these issues for the past 15 years, you know, as its center. And that was a Tuesday. That was in Massachusetts, where Yo-Yo lives. And he said, so how do you feel about meeting the rest of the ensemble? We start our tour on Saturday in Hong Kong. I said, okay, if I can get a visa. So I scrambled, and I got to Hong Kong, and I got to spend time instantly kind of on the road with the ensemble, and was so kind of utterly blown away by them all, as individuals and collectively. And that was the beginning, and that was, you know, almost 5 years ago.
Morgan, I'm not surprised that in that initial conversation with Yo-Yo Ma, you felt inspired enough to decide, I'll follow him. I mean, he's such an interesting person. You see it in the film, and you see it quickly. I mean, in the first 20 minutes or so, there were a couple of moments for me that stood out as so interesting and thoughtful, and I want to hit two of them. First of all, you kind of take us back to when he was a child, you know, sort of this prodigy. I think there's a shot of him playing music for President Kennedy at one point when he was seven. And he was such a sensation from early in his life, but he really opens up to you about what that meant for him, which is that he didn't, it's not that he doesn't love music, but he didn't exactly choose it. And there was sort of a reckoning that, you know, what does it all mean if I didn't choose it, if it sort of chose me, that as I get older and go throughout my life, what does that mean? And should I be looking for other meaning? You know, what you included that early on. What did that mean to you?
Well, it's interesting because he had this, you know, midlife crisis kind of in his mid-30s. His father had died, who had been his teacher. He had been kind of on this treadmill since he was seven. He was a prodigy, so he had been performing and famous since he was very young. And I think it was the first moment where he kind of stood back and said, you know, I'm traveling the world, I'm playing 250 shows a year, and I'm playing the same repertoire over and over. Like, what does this all mean? Is this something I want to do? Do I even want to be a musician? And, you know, I talked to his family about this too, and I think it really was this moment where he came back after thinking about it and said, yes, I want to do music if I can use music as a tool to understand the world, and even more than that, maybe try and change the world a little bit. And I think that was the idea that started him on this path that led him to doing collaborations like with Bobby McFerrin. It led him to go to meet with the Bushmen in Africa, which you see in the film. It led him to his collaborations with Astor Piazzolla and Ennio Morricone and all of these things. But I think really then the Silk Road Ensemble was the thing he had been kind of floating around, trying different things. The Goat Rodeo is another one. But once he came to this idea of the Silk Road Ensemble, you know, it became the perfect metaphor. You know, and initially it started with this idea of bringing musicians from Silk Road countries together. And this was kind of 2 years of gathering musicians for this kind of crazy boot camp where they all came together at Tanglewood, which you see some in the film. But I think even more than that, it's become the perfect metaphor for what he wants to do, because the Silk Road was a trade route going back thousands of years where everything from, you know, Islam to algebra to pasta found its way from one end of one continent to another. But it's the idea that we've been sharing culture and ideas for thousands of years, and we need to look at our commonalities, not our differences, and how, and culture is the perfect way to do it. It's how we understand more about other cultures by their food and their music and their art than we do certainly by their politics or their religion or those other things, the things that tend to alienate us from one another. And I think that has become the kind of motivating force of this whole thing.
Well, as someone who's prone to existential crises, to see Yo-Yo Ma deal with his, it made me feel, wow, if Yo-Yo Ma, who seems to have had it all figured out, can deal with this. As Yo-Yo Ma says, he's one of 7 billion people in the world trying to figure out, you know, sort of what are we doing here? And so then the other question, sort of on those the same lines, Morgan, is you see the success, the early success of Silk Road, but then Yo-Yo says, you know, we couldn't just keep doing it to keep doing it. You know, we had to explain why. You know, because they learned through some work that there was some great and beautiful things happening, but you had to ask the question, are we going to keep doing this, and what does it really mean? And why don't you tell the audience, you know, sort of without giving away the rest of the film, what you, and kind of what Yo-Yo Ma, how you see the Silk Road Ensemble, what it really does mean now?
Well, you know, I think there was that kind of moment that if we put together kind of a snazzy ensemble of the best of these musicians from these different cultures and go and play in the same cultural palaces over and over, that's nice, but that's not really what our goal is. And so, you know, we touch on it in the film, but even beyond the film, you know, what they do, I mean, the whole collective, they have a whole, you know, organization that has, you know, all kinds of curricula they develop for schools. When they tour, the moment they land in a town, they go, they work in schools virtually every single day they're on tour. They go and do workshops. They meet at universities. They're really engaged citizens. I mean, Yo-Yo talks about citizenship all the time. And I think the music that happens on stage is just a small part of that. And I think, again, it becomes the kind of the driving force of it. But, I mean, we even have moments like the film opens with a pop-up concert we did with them in Istanbul, right on the banks of the Bosphorus. And that's the kind of thing of this is not trying to just do these things for elites in different cities. This is really trying to democratize these ideas and explore them and make people think about them and think about their own culture. So I think that's the kind of meaning that that Yo-Yo had to find in the work and that they've really succeeded in doing, I think.
Well, let me ask Alexander Pena, who's the director of the Rock Music Collaborative here in Rochester, if you agree with that sentiment, that they've been able to make this a little bit more egalitarian than some might expect it would be, because I know, again, that's such a value for you and for what your collaborative does.
Absolutely. I think, you know, something that happened this past year that made me think about it a lot was for the second year, we did an Around the Town concert with the Rochester Philharmonic, and we were able to collaborate side by side with our rock music students. And the second year, we chose a program that was dances from around the world. It was repertoire that was, you know, different composers, everything from Dvorak Slavonic dance to Spanish pieces and that sort of thing. And this year was actually the first year that we've had some refugee population students join our program. And the conductor of that Around the Town series was a conducting fellow. His name is Boon Hua Lien. He was a doctoral student at Eastman. And he got to pick the program, and he picked a piece that was sort of a wild card piece. It was called The Dance of the Yao People, and it was from his background. And it was, you know, of course, in some kind of Asian country. I don't know exactly where the Yao people are from. And I just remember thinking, as I saw this concert happen three different times, the third time we went there, there was the entire family of this refugee population. It's some kind of Eastern Asian family. And they were there at the classical concert. They heard all these different pieces. And the moment that that piece started, it was a whole different collections of harmonies and sounds and rhythms that were not Western culture. And the light on the face of this family and kids went, oh. And it was almost like they really felt accepted. The image I had was like, wow, we're our people, our history, our culture is actually so accepted to the point where it's being presented to us by an orchestra, you know, by this very Western classical kind of machine, you know. And it was so validating. The family, I mean, with very few words that they could put together, basically thanked me so much for the experience because they really had never experienced anything like that. And I think that makes me think of exactly what Silk Road and Ensemble is doing. It's providing also, you know, wonder, but also just the idea that you can be a part of something that you are not, you know, you're not an alien to this, that you can really bring any culture to it and communicate and express and share.
Well, that might be a good time for me to read an email from a listener named David. And I don't know if David has seen the film, The Music of Strangers, that we're talking about, but he might have heard part of our discussion earlier. And David just writes, music may not be able to stop a bullet, but it may be able to stop one from being fired in the first place. Morgan, what do you make of that?
I love that quote. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, really, I think when I thought about this film and when I kind of break it down to what this collaborative is about, and this is an idea that Yo-Yo talks about, it's the idea of empathy. And in a way, the music of strangers is kind of a contradiction in terms, because you can't be a stranger with somebody if you make music with them. It's really what they're all trying to get out of it is understanding. And I feel like in a day and age where it's so easy to demonize the other and where we talk about building walls, I think culture offers the opportunity to build bridges and to understand these other people. And I feel even just from having done this film, I have a much better understanding of the real culture and the people of Syria and Iran and China. And that's just the beginning. But I think that the idea of empathy is crucial. And as somebody who makes films, films are about, I think Roger Ebert called films empathy machines. It's about creating understanding with somebody who maybe seems foreign to you, but you recognize something of your own experience in theirs. And I think music has the power to do the exact same thing. And I just think that's so valuable in 2016.
All right, Mona Sagatola-Salami?
Something that just reminded me of, I hadn't been thinking of in terms of this, there's a great project, the West Eastern Divan Orchestra, that was Edward Said and Daniel Barenboim bringing together students from Israel and from other Middle Eastern countries to make music together, that at least they knew each other as people, they knew each other as collaborators in a youth orchestra, and the impact as they continued to work on that project. So that's another one with that sort of empathy.
Well, there was an article written this morning, or I think it's actually a couple of days old, written in, I think it comes from The Telegraph. And I want to read from this because if the panel is generally agreeing that music does have this power, and I think the film, I think Morgan's film demonstrates that when we're not appropriating, when we are respecting cultures, when we're opening our minds and sort of learning and sharing in that way, the music has tremendous power. You know, should we decide as a culture that it's too important to allow kids to grow up without it? This is from The Telegraph this past Sunday. Nicola Benedetti is an award-winning violinist, and she said adults should stop pandering to what they think children want when it comes to their musical education, ensuring instead that they do what is best for them. And she compares learning about music to healthy eating. She said children should be made to listen to the classics just as they are told to eat broccoli. Quote, "It drives me crazy when people say, but they don't like that kind of music. They like Britney Spears." And this is what she says, quote, "I'm like, they also don't like broccoli and they would rather have candy. But we still know that broccoli is good for you. Surely education is something that should be determined by adults and not by kids." That's from Nicola Benedetti saying there's too much good that comes from teaching, I think she's going to say classical music, but really sort of music with depth, and that we should prioritize it no matter if kids like it or not. Ellen, what do you think of that?
Well, first I want to say to Morgan, congratulations on one of the best documentaries I have ever seen. I was prepared not to like it, I have to say, because I'm often very skeptical of fusions and the ways in which Western music often takes over other musics, you know, without reciprocity. And I have to say that by the end of this movie, I was in tears. I mean, it was just a beautiful explanation of what happens when people with dignity and respect get together and treat each other ethically and well. And the music was especially interesting because it didn't push one cultural music over another. It was really beautifully done. But I also have to say one thing that we haven't said before. What really made this so important or meaningful to me was the interspersing of those news clips from these musicians, what they had gone through with their families. I mean, that was just incredibly powerful. And I just have to give you a big hug over the air.
Thank you. I accept the hug. Gladly. The thing that was so important to me about bringing in some of these other musicians' experiences from other cultures is that I feel like in America and in the West, we tend to look at culture, and we're talking about education here too, you know, as, you know, arts education as something that's nice but non-essential.
Yeah.
You know, it's like frosting on a cake.
Mm-hmm.
And I would argue that it's the plate that the cake sits on. It's foundational. And
yeah.
That we really need to come back to that idea that culture teaches us in fact, the most important skills, how to be creative, how to be collaborative, how to be innovative. Those are things that come out of being somebody who's engaged in culture and music and art and other things. And I think looking at the experiences of musicians from countries that have had cultural revolutions, literally, you know, China, Syria, Iran, even Spain under Franco, they're not called cultural revolutions by accident. I mean, culture is a very potent force. And in the West, to see it so kind of sidelined or treated as, you know, a nice elective, but not essential, to me has, you know, been something I've been frustrated with for a long time. So I felt like seeing the kind of sacrifices and the kind of weight put on artists in other countries should stand to help remind us of just how powerful it can be here in the West.
Ellen, you want to weigh in? Go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to relate to the quote that Evan read. Music should be taught to children because it's a beautiful thing, and all musics have their beauty. So the parent who says that a child must listen to the great classics is teaching more than just music. That parent is teaching power, coercion, and all sorts of other things that we'd maybe rather not do with in these days. So my advice to that writer, whoever she is to allow her children to listen to any music, but listen carefully and understand what they're hearing. And that child may naturally go toward other musics as it grows.
Okay. Mona Segetola-Salami, force him to listen to it?
No.
And by the way, I think a lot of conversations are really valuable about how do we make music more egalitarian, and how do we reach younger audiences, and how do we reach more diverse audiences and make them want to? That's great. But what she's saying is, they don't want to, too bad. This is too important.
I mean, if you're learning an instrument, it's helpful to have discipline, and learning music, as Alex can talk about, teaches you to how to learn, you know, not with forcing, but the fact is that I, as a music student, you know, didn't like to focus, but the even trying, right, even the attempt to do a bit of it made a lot of difference in how I was able to focus a bit more and learn. But yeah, that whole thing about broccoli, I think, is kind of awful. And Jeremy Denk, the writer, has joked about, you know, Andre Rieu, certain music is cheese and certain music is broccoli, and where do we fall on the continuum?
But hey, I guess broccoli's good.
Yeah.
Some of us actually like it.
I like broccoli.
And then, but the other thing is then the notion of, yeah, teaching power and coercion. That's a movie that's also out now. The Lobster uses Dmitri Shostakovich's music, and he knew about the power of music he had to resist, but the power of music that the state had to sort of enforce certain things or tell composers to create music. You know, this is if we talk about cultural revolutions, people singing together in choruses of, you know, essentially music as oppression, which does come up in a recent New Yorker article. I won't get too far, but Alex Ross talks about the power of music in negative situations, too. So I think understanding it's a powerful thing for good or for ill, hopefully mostly for good, but understanding this context is important.
The Alex Ross piece she's referring to is from I think it's from two New Yorker issues ago. It's called When Music is Violence. Alex Ross is always worth reading on this subject. Very, very interesting stuff. Alexander, how do you feel about, you know, making kids sit down with it and at least try to consume it whether they want to or not?
Well, the music education and educator in me sort of cringes a little bit in the picture of sitting someone down and forcing them to listen to it. I think of the best experiences being that, just experiential. And I think moving with the music, dancing to the music, being artistic to the music, drawing, you know, talking about inspiration or improvising over it. I think I completely agree with. And, you know, the quote that comes to mind is the Frederick Douglass quote, which is, it is easier to build strong children than to prepare broken men. And I think that what lacks a lot of public school education due to pressures of time, the Rock Music Collaborative has the time to actually spend, you know, explaining concepts of music from Ghana and how it can be applied to orchestral music and things like that. And we're really able to have conversations about culture and about what this music means and what it means to other people. What does it mean to you now, the first time that you listen to it? And I think that opening children's minds to that exchange and to that understanding that you must collaborate when you're being musical with people really will lead to stronger adults, hopefully, and a stronger human civilization, as we're kind of all kind of hinting at.
Well, we're down to 90 seconds here. Tom writes to us on Twitter, what if open carry, instead of a gun, we each carried a harmonica? Well, that's a start, Tom, and that's a beautiful image. I fear we're a long way off from that in this world. But let me close with Morgan Neville. Morgan, we had a few listeners who just wanted to know what Silk Road is doing now, and how would you answer that question?
They are going to do a tour in August. And I know they're going everywhere from Tanglewood to the Hollywood Bowl. So you, once you're online, you can find all those dates. So they're going to be around.
And how do you, Morgan, now, as having made this beautiful film, that once again, listeners, you can see Saturday at the Little Theater at 1 p.m., The Music of Strangers. It was sold out in its first showing. You want to get tickets in advance if you want to go on Saturday at 1 p.m. Morgan, in 45 seconds, you know, this relationship you've built with Yo-Yo Ma, what is... you would probably describe yourself as someone of privilege, someone who's had a great opportunity in life. What have you gained most from that relationship?
Yo-Yo is, in fact, not only probably the nicest human being I've ever met, which surprises me to no end that somebody can have that kind of renown. But the lesson I think I've learned from him is that he's taken all of that capital of who he is and what celebrity he has, and he spent it in the best possible way. Mm-hmm. And there are so few people that do that. He says, look, if you want to know what I care about and if you want to follow me, this is where I want to go. And he's so good at pivoting and taking that attention and shining it where he really thinks it belongs. And that's something I'm going to take with me for the rest of my life.
I will second Ellen's congratulations to you on the success of The Music of Strangers, Yo-Yo Ma, and the Silk Road Ensemble. We'll be watching at the Little Theater on Saturday at 1. And Morgan, thank you for taking the time to join the program today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I mentioned Ellen Koskoff, professor of ethnomusicology. Thank you so much, Ellen. Great learning from you this hour.
Thank you.
Always enjoy learning from my colleague Mona Segatola-Slami from Down the Hall at 91.5. You going to work now?
Nope, I'm off this week.
This is how you spend your vacation on Connections?
I'm going to go see Ben Folds tonight with the Chamber Music Ensemble, Y Music.
Oh, beautiful. Well, thank you, Mona. And Alexander Pena, continued great work and success that you have with Rock Music Collaborative. Thank you for the work you do, and thanks for being here.
Thanks so much, Evan.
All right, Deprina Godboldo, thank you very much. Rob, our engineer, our thanks to Megan Mac producer. I'm Evan Dawson. We'll talk with you on a Thursday.